dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is my great pleasure and high privilege to have with us at the moment a man whose intelligence on virtually every aspect of that war is non pari, as they say in France, unsurpassed. He has written extensively in his columns at National Review Online and at PJ Media, among other places. He has written best-selling books, including The Grand Jihad. He has been much in evidence in various other media outlets, including Fox News, helping the rest of us understand what the devil is going on so many topics, particularly in the nexus between national security and the law. He is, of course, Andrew C. McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, now pundit extraordinaire and author and so much more, and good friend of this program. We're always glad to have him with us. Andy, welcome back.
Frank, thanks so much for having me.
You have been writing extraordinarily important material, Andy. I don't know how you do it. I hardly have time to read it, let alone imagine how fast you're writing it. But you are informing us about a kind of what I think of as increasingly an amalgamation of controversial decisions, problematic investigations, dubious judgment calls, and the like. And let me just tick off a couple of them and ask you just to dive in. The whole charge that there has been collusion between the Trump campaign, the transition team, perhaps even the administration with the Russians on the elections and more, the obstruction of justice allegations that have come as a result of the firing, most notably of James Comey, an old friend of yours. The Mueller special counsel, his role, his investigation, the need to define what its limits are, if any, and his evident conflict of interest, it seems to me, and not least the decision by Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself, which has set in train several of these very unfortunate developments. Give us, if you would, just sort of an overview of what is happening and what we should make of it and where we go from here with respect to the above.
Well, I think, Frank, that the whole idea of collusion is more illusion than collusion. You know, the very premise that the Russians would need help from the Trump campaign to make mischief when they make mischief in all our elections has always been sort of an oddity to me, but there is no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and whatever efforts the Russians made to meddle in the 2016 campaign. That whole, what's been called meddling, that whole escapade is probably worth a conversation unto itself. But I mean, as far as Trump is concerned, the collusion and the new a narrative that it's sort of melded into, which is obstruction, are both based on a false premise. The collusion thing, that there actually was a partnership of some kind between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and the obstruction is based on the idea that Trump interfered with an investigation, and that is, I guess, fallacious on at least two fronts. One is the president is the head of the executive branch. He actually gets to make decisions about investigations. And contrary to what my old friend Jim Comey seemed to think, the president supervises the FBI director, not the other way around. But the more basic thing is that you can't obstruct a fraud. And what Trump was trying to do, it's clear now, I think, was expose the fact that the FBI did not regard the president of the United States as a suspect in a criminal investigation when the FBI and the and other parts of the government were conducting themselves as if, publicly at least, as if the president was a suspect, which was very damaging to Trump's capacity to govern. And, you know, I know there's a resistance and it's a very polarized country, but it's not a good thing for the country, no matter who you support, no matter what your political philosophy of the government is. If the president is paralyzed in a way that he's unable to conduct the governance day to day of the United States, and yet that is what has befallen Trump on account of what I what seems to me to be a false narrative and one that was really intentionally promoted. So to me, these two storylines run into each other.
Yeah, the artificially promoted piece of it is, of course, fascinating. And just talk, if you would, a little bit about the Comey role in promoting that false narrative and how that engineered the appointment of his friend, and I think that's an understatement, his colleague of many years, as well as friend, Robert Mueller, as the special counsel. And the degree to which the Mueller investigation, under the terms, as you've pointed out, Andy, of the Justice Department's own regulations, would seem to have an incapacitating conflict of interest as a result.
Well, I think the most critical event here, Frank, is the March 20th testimony that then-Director Comey gave to the House Intelligence Committee, in which he made an extraordinary public proclamation, really against the protocols of law enforcement, admitting not only that there was an investigation, a counterintelligence investigation of Russian interference in the election, which, by the way, was not at that point, that was old news that had been out there since January. But adding to it that they were also, as part of this, looking into the possibility of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Putin regime, and gratuitously adding that they would be assessing whether any criminal violations had occurred, which, as any person with common sense would understand, his making that announcement in the extraordinary way it was made caused the media to write that and to report that they had been that he had confirmed that Trump was a suspect in a criminal investigation. And I, you know, there's a lot of things I think you can fault the media for. I don't think you can fault them on that one. That's pretty much what anybody with an IQ over 11 would have taken away from Comey's testimony. And it was even more extraordinary, we now know, because at the same time, Comey was telling the president and the Congress privately, not publicly, that Trump was not a suspect. So we now know that, you know, he's making this announcement that has the country convinced that the president, you know, is 8/10 of the way toward impeachment. And then we have the FBI director privately assuring the president, you know, not to worry, you're not a suspect.
Crazy making, to say the least.
Yeah. But I think it explains why Trump fired him.
But it just quickly tie this into the Mueller business. And is there, in fact, a conflict of interest that should result in, if not the termination of his role as special counsel, certainly a very, very definite constricting of the purview of that investigation?
Well, yeah, to cut to the end, because I know you're short on time, the Mueller investigation is problematic from the start because it's appointed outside of the regulations that control when a special counsel is supposed to be appointed. The special counsel is supposed to be investigating a criminal investigation. Unless there's evidence of a crime, there's no point in having a special counsel. You don't need one for a counterintelligence investigation because that's agent intelligence work. It's not lawyer work. So Mueller was appointed without there being a criminal investigation, and thus there are no parameters, no limitations whatsoever on his jurisdiction. And while I think it's very problematic that he has a close relationship with Comey, and problematic that he's staffed up with a lot of people who are politically explosive in this context, I'm much more troubled by the fact that the investigation itself has no limitations. That's as we know from our previous experience with special prosecutors, That's a ticket to disaster.
Andy McCarthy, we're going to have the privilege of a further conversation with you. We're going to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor and now one of the most perspicacious men in America on matters involving our national security and the law. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're talking with Andy McCarthy. He has been very closely following and incredibly helpfully illuminating some of the really vexing challenges that the Trump administration and the country are facing in the context of the various charges and countercharges and institutional crises, even, I would argue, constitutional crises that have been developing surrounding the issue of, was there Russian involvement in our election? Was there collusion with the Russians by the Trump team? Was there an obstruction of justice? And on and on. And you've illuminated, again, much of that very helpfully in the first segment. But let me turn to this question of Jeff Sessions. You have written about his recusal and how it was unwarranted and whether there's now an opportunity, in fact, a necessity in light of what we've just been talking about, for him to be once again allowed to involve himself in some of these matters as the Attorney General of the United States. Would you develop that thought?
Sure. Well, the recusal of a Justice Department official, Frank, in many ways, it's the flip side of the same coin as when you appoint a special counsel, because it involves the inability for ethical reasons for the Justice Department because of conflict of interest reasons to pursue an investigation, which is why you turn to an outside semi-autonomous lawyer. And not surprisingly, the same principles apply, which is to say you don't recuse yourself unless there is a criminal investigation or a criminal prosecution that warrants your recusal because of the conflict of interest. In this case, Sessions recused himself because of what was called the Russia investigation, which then and at the time, and so far as we know, even now, was never a criminal investigation. It's a counterintelligence case, which is just an information gathering effort. It's not the building of a prosecution.
That seems to be a rather significant point that has somehow been overlooked in all of this, Andy. How could that be?
It's a crucially significant point, Frank, and it's been very frustrating to try to get it across to people from the start. I often hark back to the mid-90s and the catastrophe that we had over the wall, which was these regulations that the Justice Department hamstrung themselves with, which was a separation between the law enforcement side of the House and the intelligence side of the House. But there is this divide, and it's always been the case that you're not allowed in the FBI or the Justice Department to use intelligence gathering powers, which are for foreign threats to national interests, to build criminal cases. If you want to build a criminal case, you have to use the criminal authorities that are available to the Justice Department and the FBI. It's important here because they've said from the start the Russia investigation is a counterintelligence investigation, which means it's not an effort to build a criminal case. It's an effort to gather intelligence in order to understand how a foreign power, in this case Russia, may pose a threat to American interests. And it's important in the context we're talking about, because whether you're talking about appointing an independent prosecutor or the recusal of the attorney general, those things have to be predicated, or at least under the regulations are supposed to be predicated, only by a criminal prosecution or investigation, which counterintelligence is not.
Yeah. And Andy, just to return to this point, because I've learned from you about this Department of Justice regulation with respect to the need for individuals who find themselves in pursuit of a possible criminal investigation or prosecution, I guess is the operative word here, of individuals who have a conflict of interest to recuse themselves from doing that. Is that not correct? I'm sure I don't have the formulation just right, but what's the story there, and why isn't that operating with the Mueller inquiry?
Yeah, to get to why we ended up where we've ended up with Mueller, the Trump administration gave conflicting explanations for why Comey was fired. Ron Rosenstein, who's the deputy attorney general, wrote a memorandum that mainly relied on Comey's performance during the Hillary Clinton emails investigation. Trump later indicated probably the correct reason, which is that he fired Comey over exasperation in connection with the Russia investigation, specifically that he wouldn't tell the American people that the president was not a suspect. I think when the Democrats went crazy over the conflicting explanations, Rosenstein got spooked and decided to wash his hands of it by appointing a special counsel, even though the rules did not require a special counsel and, in fact, didn't embrace the idea of a special counsel because there was no criminal investigation at the time. So I think we ended up with Mueller outside the rules of when you appoint a special counsel, and Rosenstein doubled down on that error by not only appointing one, but not giving him any finite jurisdictional mandate. So he's got basically, it's almost like a general warrant. He basically got a fishing expedition.
Oh, Andy, well, this is very troubling indeed. Let me turn to one other piece that you've helped explicate for all of us at National Review Online, namely the Supreme Court's decision with respect to President Trump's executive order imposing a pause on immigration, not a travel ban, a pause on immigration from six countries that happen to be either failed states or actual hostile nations to this country. You considered it to be a mixed bag, and I'd like you to very quickly talk a little bit about why.
Yeah, well, I think 2 points on this, Frank, do the trick. The first is that to the extent it's a victory for Trump, which I think it's much less of one than has been trumpeted, it's that you can glean from the opinion, even though the court was not full-throated about this, that the justices, at least a majority of them, reject the idea there is this what I've called Trump jurisprudence, which is that this president is going to be judged by different legal standards than every other president, such that when he does things that other presidents could do without difficulty, the courts frustrate and obstruct him. I think the court has rejected the idea of a second set of rules for Trump. So that's the positive side. The negative side is that the court really did not reject what the lower courts had done in the way of blocking the so-called travel ban. They narrowed the stays on the execution of the order, but where they finally ultimately come out is that they endorse this idea of vicariously giving American constitutional rights to aliens outside the United States through the fig leaf of having Americans who are somehow in relationships with them and detrimentally affected by regulations that keep them out of the country. And I think they come out to the preposterous place that if you have what they call a bona fide relationship with one of these aliens, you have a right that can be enforced by the courts and that can stop a national security ban from taking place, even though we're in a situation where this is a temporary travel restriction and you'd only be forced to wait 90 to 120 days, which is not like it's forever. And the travel order itself has a provision that allows it to be waived in extraordinary cases. So why the court had to jump in and legislate its own exemptions beyond me.
Andy, this is an incredibly important point. Thank you for visiting with us at some length about it today, and I hope you'll make it back to us again very soon. In the meantime, folks, please check out Andy's collected works at National View Online, PJ Media. Come back to us again soon, Andy, if you would.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Rowan Scarborough, I'm very pleased to say, is in the House. He is a historically significant figure in the national security reporting business in this country, as far as I'm concerned. His career spans some 26 years at the Washington Times, among other publications. He has contributed to our understanding of these issues with his visits from time to time, and he's always a welcome guest. Rowan, thank you so much for finding some time to join us today. Good to talk with you.
Frank, great to be with you.
Rowan, one of the things that I've particularly admired about your reporting over the years is you have an understanding of and have really shed considerable light upon something that might be called the culture of the military, the social fabric, if you will, of our armed forces. And the assaults that have been made against it over the years, particularly of the Obama administration, culminating most recently, I guess, in its decision to insinuate into the military transgender individuals as some sort of social engineering to, I guess, improve their status in the population more generally. Rowan, talk a little bit about the implications of that for the military. And you've reported that the House Armed Services Committee, which I guess is in the process now of marking up its National Defense Authorization Act for next year, is going to be taking up.
That's right. President Obama lifted the ban on transgender troops serving openly in the military. And that has put a lot of pressure on the chain of command, because it injects commanders directly into decisions about how someone transitions from a male to a female, and how are they treated by other soldiers and service members, and do they get to take time off or not time off. But that's just the beginning, because Defense Secretary Ash Carter left a very important deadline on his desk when he left the Pentagon in January, and James Mattis now has to make the decision on whether the Pentagon is going to actively recruit transgender people into the military. And that's a very, very big decision, because there's about 20 stipulations that have to be met on whether the person is even suitable to join. So a whole new bureaucracy is going to be created. And in the meantime, I reported today, they've been doing sensitivity training that is supposed to culminate next month. And they're given possible vignettes about how do you deal with a male to female, who's in the shower with male genitalia, but they're actually in the woman's shower. So these are things the Army is putting out about how soldiers have to deal. So you can see it's a big revolution inside the military, without a doubt. And it's in the lap of James Mattis right now. And the House Armed Services Committee, some Republicans want to write something into the bill that frames this, curtails it, puts limits on it. And they were still drafting some stuff yesterday. And it should play out later today when they mark up the bill. But it may have something to do with, if you're going to do this, Secretary Mattis, let's not actively go out and recruit transgenders as if, you know, that they are a special diversity-driven group that we have to have, you know, a half a percent of. Let's not go that far. I think that's one of the thoughts that Republicans have.
I pray that the Armed Services Committee is going to be taking this up, along with other things like, you know, women in combat and, for that matter, gays in the military. But I understand that James Mattis has actually already endorsed the whole Obama social engineering agenda. Is that correct or not?
Well, he said at his confirmation hearing, I'm not going to change anything unless someone tells me it's a problem. Well, I think some of the services are going through the deputy secretary work, and telling him that they do have some reservations about how this is going to be worked out, the funding, what does this do to our ability to fill billets, because it's going to mean that people are going to be taking time off for surgeries and things like that. So as July 1 approaches, you may see that Mattis will decide to delay it and let the military do more data collection, because actually, you know, they just lifted the ban on current troops last summer. So what data have they collected so far on how that's working? I doubt if they've collected much at all, because there just hasn't been the time. So it might be a good idea to first look at what's happening now before you make a very momentous decision that you're going to actively recruit people.
Hey, Rowan, there's so much more to talk about on all of that, and I look forward to visiting with you after the House does its work. But maybe we could turn to one of the other issues you've called attention to. It's been very troubling to me for a long time, and yet it seems not to have gotten the attention it deserves, and that is the connection between the North Koreans and the Iranians, both with respect to their ballistic missile programs and, it would appear, their nuclear weapons activities. Tell us what you have been finding on that score.
Well, last week, the main opposition group to the Iranian mullahs, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, put out a white paper on the ballistic missile programs now happening in Iran. And Iran, of course, is following the lead of North Korea. North Korea views ballistic missiles as vital to its survival and vital to keeping its neighbors intimidated and in check. And Iran is doing the exact same thing, according to the resistance group that has a very good spy network inside the country. They've proven that. And so what has Iran done since the joint agreement with the allies and President Obama? They have ramped up ballistic missile production, according to this group. They now are operating 42 ballistic missile centers doing various types of development and production work around the country. 12 of these had never been disclosed before until the spy network came up with the data. So the nuclear agreement has not curtailed Iran's devotion to ballistic missiles. If anything, it has increased. And of course, we know what Iran is after. They're after long-range missiles one day that can reach Europe and can reach our continent. That's their ultimate goal, number one. And number two, the group shows that they're putting more launch pads in the southern part of the country to threaten shipping, which would include us, of course.
Finally, you have been following closely over the years, Rowan, the saga of what's been happening in terms of a politicized intelligence community. The role in that by John Brennan, who was the CIA director under Barack Obama, of course, seems to be a particularly egregious example of the phenomenon and a contributor to it. What do we know, if anything, about Brennan and this so-called Steele dossier, this fabricated so-called intelligence report about Donald Trump's conduct in Russia that might have compromised him?
Well, here's one thing we know about John. It was Brennan who alerted Comey to what he thought were contact between Trump people and Russians during the campaign. So if there's anybody singularly responsible for getting Comey to begin this Russian collusion investigation, it was John Brennan. And John Brennan, of course, was more than just CIA director. He was a confidant of President Obama. He was on the 2008 campaign. He was a White House advisor to Obama before he went to the CIA. And he hates Donald Trump.
Partisan through and through.
Yes. Now, on the Steele dossier, we know the FBI got the dossier. What is still a mystery is how much did they rely on it? Because Comey told Senator Grassley one story about it. Yes, yet there are some press reports that it was the dossier, which is totally discredited, which was used along with the Brennan information to start the investigation. So When Brennan is asked about the dossier, he said he did not rely on it. I think that needs to be tested by, you know, interrogation, maybe in a closed session when you can discuss classified information. Because I find it hard to believe that a dossier that was in the hands of CIA and the hands of the FBI had no effect on John Brennan whatsoever. I doubt that highly.
Especially given his agenda, which, as you've documented so well, has been acted on in any number of settings, and I think to the great detriment of our, well, not only our intelligence community as a nonpartisan operation, but also to the detriment of our national security, indeed. We have to leave it at that. Rowan Scarborough, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's great to talk with you. We look forward to doing so again.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Diana West. We have the privilege of visiting with her each week about this time. She is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist, now writes a brilliant blog at dianawest.net, also frequently is placing pieces in other outlets, notably The Daily Caller. She has written two terrific and, fortunately, best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. And she is the object of great interest from at least part of our listening audience, Right Wing Watch and Media Matters, who've taken you to task for comments you made last week in this program, Diana West. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of their criticism. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Always a pleasure. And always, of course, our friends at Right Wing Watch are scribbling this down so that we can continue being discussed. Well, I was actually quite pleased to have Right Wing Watch call us out on our conversation. It was actually a long conversation. I was generously allotted several segments to discuss many things.
We had a chance to really visit at length, which I'm very grateful for.
Yes, and in the course of that, we did talk about the unsolved murder of Seth Rich, who was director of VOTA expansion data at the DNC last summer, which was something that they singled out for scorn and opprobrium, simply to discuss in the context of the entire DNC hacking, Russia, Trump scandal, which it remains an unsolved murder that may or may not shed light on what happened at the DNC. But the bottom line is, we do not know because no one has examined the server who can be trusted by the American people. We just have a DNC contractor whose work has actually been subject to retraction in subsequently. And I speak of CrowdStrike. And this remains a mystery as to why the FBI would allow such an important study to be outsourced, again, to a DNC contractor. And that was something that CrowdStrike took exception to.
Diana West is with us. I'm very pleased to say we're talking with her about some of the scandals and outrages and controversies that she covers so well, among other places, at The Daily Caller. And, of course, at dianawest.net. And, Diana, you were talking a moment ago about the FBI and contracting out to CrowdStrike its investigation of the DNC computer systems at the center of this controversy about Russian hacking and all the rest of it. One of the other prominent figures in some of these controversies is, of course, former National Security Advisor to the President, Susan Rice, under President Obama. She has apparently managed to have her documents that may bear on her role in some of the scandalous behavior stashed away at the presidential library for, interestingly enough, the next 5 years. Tell us what that's about and what options may be available to keep them from being put beyond reach of proper investigation.
Yes, well, we learn about this from the excellent people at Judicial Watch who, in the public interest, attempted to allow the American people to see what materials pertain to the unmasking by Susan Rice of American citizens associated with the Trump campaign. This is what we've been led to believe exist. They received a response from the NSC to the effect that these records had, as you say, been stashed, although that's not what the NSC said, but had been stashed at the Obama Library, which of course doesn't exist yet in brick and mortar. And according to statute, these would not be available to the public for 5 years. A scandal. An absolute scandal that, again, is not being covered by the mainstream media. But the key point here is that it doesn't have to be, because it turns out that this is simply a measure that can actually be overridden by, number one, the President of the United States, number two, the Congress, and number three, the special counsel, Robert Mueller. All three of them have power to ensure that these documents come to light in the matter of national interest. And so my feeling is, my very strong feeling is that this becomes an essential point of concern to all of us to see if anyone takes that step. Does President Trump understand that he has the power to do this? I don't know, but if someone should tell him, if someone's listening, they should let him know. The Congress certainly does. Mueller certainly does. Who will call the bluff, in other words? That becomes the question. And if they don't, if no one does, we learn, again, the power of the swamp to simply never drain itself or allow its denizens to participate in the draining. And so this really is an important point to watch.
Well, we will, and I know you will, at dianawest.net as well as elsewhere, Diana. Let me ask you about one of the other pieces that you've written recently concerning a hearing that took place last week in the United States Senate Homeland Security Committee concerning the phenomenon of, Sharia supremacism is the way I would describe it. I don't think that's how they discussed it in the course of the hearing, which really raises the point. Are we, in fact, incapable at this moment of a, as you call it, fact-based discussion of Islam?
We are incapable. That is the word for having this discussion. And I think that it is forever thus going forward, in my opinion, that we have lost the capacity to have this discussion. I think the Senate hearing exemplified this when you saw first the treatment of the two women coming out of Islam. One is a Muslim reformer, the other a famous apostate.
Those would be Azra Nomani and Ayan Hirsi Ali, respectively. Yeah.
Respectively. And they were essentially shunned by the Democratic senators, and so that was one strike against the hearing.
Including female Democratic senators.
Yes, they were female. This was played up quite a lot. I don't think that was the main point. The main point was they didn't want to talk about Islam, but when I actually viewed the hearing, I would say that neither of these witnesses did either. And not to go into the whole concept of how to talk about Islam again, I think the salient point was, my takeaway here was, that we are so far from any debate, wide-ranging debate, that we even saw Hirsi Ali make the case that one thing the senators are missing, the United States is missing in not defining the enemy, was in not recognizing the threat. And she actually defined that threat to include the rise of right-wing extremism in Europe, by which she defined front and center Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom in the Netherlands. And this was a great shock. And I will say that the reaction to this piece, I've gotten a huge reaction to this piece by people who are shocked that Hirsi Ali would say this. But I just say, look at the video here to watch it for yourself, because it is a shocking moment, but one that we really should mark in this historical period.
I must say, I am a very huge fan of Ayan Hirsi Ali, and I'm disappointed that that she would say that. I assume this is partly born of her experiences in the Netherlands herself, but still, I think that's a terrible mistake. And it is important to have clarity. And one of the things that, as you know as well as I, Geert Wilders has been trying to do is bring clarity to the needed debate in his own country. And I think we have much to learn from him in so doing. Diane West, we have a great deal to learn from you. This is a much shorter segment than we did last week, but I'm grateful to you whenever we can find some time with you, and I appreciate all you do at DianaWest.net, Daily Caller, and elsewhere. Come back to us again next week if you would.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.